If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Snakes, zombies, sharks, heights, speaking in public. The list of fears is endless. But while you're clutching your blanket in the dark, wondering if that sound in the hall was actually a footstep, the real danger is in your hand when you're behind the wheel. And while you might think a great white shark is scary, what's really terrifying and even deadly is distracted driving. Eyes forward, don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Welcome to another episode of 100 Words or Less, the podcast. I'm your host, Ray Harkins, and thank you very much for joining me. I'm absolutely exhausted. And let me be honest, 2015 started off pretty terribly for me. Terrible, terrible things. It's stuff that, like, when I describe it, everyone's like, oh yeah, that kind of sucks. But when you're in the middle of something, it feels like, dude, I'm never going to get out of this. So I'll break it down in a minute. Let's get to who's on the show, why you came here in the first place, not to hear me whine and complain about how my 2015 hasn't started off that good. No one cares. I hope some of you do, but I care. So I guess that in by transitive property, some of you should. The reason you are here is to listen to a conversation that I had with one Mr. John Loudon from the band Restorations. Sneaky good. They're one of those bands who it's like every record just gets better and better. And I honestly didn't check into them until 2011. I was aware of the band and I enjoyed their recorded output. But then watching them at the fest in Gainesville, Florida, play in front of, I don't know, 500 or so people, they just owned it. And it was so good. And ever since then, I've been like, dude, all in on Restorations. Great band. And to be honest, I should have paid closer attention to their new full length that came out, because it's like I said, it's sneaky good. And it probably, if I spent more time with it, I'll bet you it would have crept into my year end list. But yes, we are interviewing him. He is the lead vocalist and guitarist for the band, and just has a rich history in Philly music. You'll hear us put together some of these commonalities that we've both have as far as friends and shows we play together. I love doing that, not only in the show, but just in life. Anyways, it was a great conversation, and I'd like to give a special shout out to Jamie Coletta at Side One Dummy for hooking this up in the first place. Some business pleasantries out of the way. I haven't mentioned this in a while. I send out an email blast once a week to you, the listener. If you sign up, go to 100wordspodcast.com. On the right side of the page, you'll be able to sign up for a email list. It's free, obviously. You just type your email address in, and once a week, I'll hit you up and be like, hey, this is what happened on last week's show. And usually what I do is I kind of provide a little color, color commentary on either how the interview got set up or how it went, where we did it. Just like I said, a little more context, because a lot of people, you know, like to know that. They're invested in these interviews. It's not just like, oh, cool, dude, like, I'm glad you spoke over Skype. And sometimes that's how these conversations go, and that's how this one did with John. But there's a lot more intricacies in sometimes setting this thing up. So go sign up for the email blast. I enjoy corresponding with you that way, because a lot of people like to read it, I guess. I mean, there's close to 1,000 people that have signed up for that thing. So you just stop missing out. Sign up on it. I'm very excited to bring you some other stuff in the future. I can't hint at it yet. A week or so, you will find out more cool things that this show is being a part of, and I'm very excited to bring that to you. Let me just get this out of the way. Like I said, it's been a hellish 2015 for me so far, primarily due to home ownership. I had a leak for a long time, apparently, and I wasn't aware of it until I saw some water damage in my son's playroom. And then I was like, oh gosh, this sucks. And yeah, it does suck because the people that I pay money to dispose of the drywall and then be like, oh, hey, there's mold. Let's go ahead and get that taken care of. And just it's logistics on just money after headaches, after insurance. And it just sucks. It takes it out of you. This is the beatdown that I see people receive. And like, people have been nice. People have helped me. But it still is a matter of like, dude, there's this room in my house that is just a plague right now. And I want to get it out of the way. So being able to talk to you and put this show out here is a beautiful, beautiful distraction. And I thank you for that. And I thank you for the support of the show in general. It's just awesome. Like, we're approaching a 3-year anniversary. I've been doing this for almost 3 years. I think the biggest compliment that I get are after these interviews I do with people. And then when I post them, they were just like, dude, that was so good. Like, thank you very much for doing that. And I could tell it's not just coming from like I say this to everybody that interviews me, but it's just like, they're genuinely excited to share different stories about themselves. So podcasting is exploding. Everybody has a podcast now. That is not special. People sharing their opinions on microphones are not special. But to me, the special part of this show is the fact that I am giving a voice and a platform for people to be able to paint the picture of why it is they're doing what they're doing. And that, to me, that's the most valuable thing. That's anybody that I care about musically or artistically. That's all I care about. Like, why are they doing this in the first place? Is it in their bones? Is it because of money? Anyways, that's why I'm just trying to thin the herd, so to speak, where it's like, yeah, you can be spending time with so many different shows. And I listen to a ton of podcasts, but there's the ones that, you know, when they come delivered to my phone after I refresh, I listen to those first. And I hope that this show in some capacity is the one you listen to first. So thank you. Without further ado, here's my conversation with John Loudon, and I'll talk to you afterwards. Always hesitant to do these sort of interviews. You're in the press cycle. You're getting stuff daily, if not weekly, that is demanding of your time. I'm always hesitant with that because it's like, you obviously being a person that does a lot of interviews, you get comfortable and you get in a pattern. And not saying that your answers would be inauthentic because they're in a pattern, but you know, it just becomes comfortable because you get the same 45 questions over over and over. Yeah. And I was like, I was entertaining it. I was like, I don't know if I want to hit him at this time. But then I was like, you know what? You're a dude that has a lot of experiences that people don't typically, you know, bring up because they're just like, oh, dude, how sick is your new record?
yeah, right. What's it like touring with Madball? Yeah. Right.
Basically, what I was trying to do is give you a compliment because I knew you were intelligent enough to not just go into your press voice.
Thanks. Yeah, I try to keep it interesting. And then for the most, we tried to dial it back a little bit this time around too, and like only really do stuff we wanted to do. That usually means like people that programs or, you know, work at places that like will ask interesting questions or like decent people. You know what I mean? Like, you kind of weed out a lot of like, so tell me your sickest tour story kind of interviews. You know,
those are obviously a dime a dozen. Like.
Oh, God,
it's,
yeah.
It's so crazy because it's like that question and those sort of like tropes have existed, like you were obviously alluding to earlier, since like the zine days, where it's well, actually, you could probably even point it to like a 40-year-old question. Like, can we turn over another rock here?
So weird. It's like we get interviews sometimes where it's like, or interview requests anyway, and you like look at other interviews they've done and you're like, why did you even do this? What is wrong with you? Like, why? Yeah. Who does this benefit?
Totally. Well, I definitely think that there's a component of panic that is obviously set in regards to the, not so much from like a publicist standpoint, but they're just like, no one has any idea what actually quote unquote works. So let's just do everything. Definitely. I mean, I like exactly your approach. approach of what you're talking about, where it's like, okay, let's kind of pick the most, you know, quote unquote important things, or the stuff that will, you know, not be so mundane that'll kind of just drive us crazy. I start these things off with just my own sort of like personal sort of entry point to kind of, you know, you, your music, that sort of stuff. I had a awakening in regards to restorations. I was aware of you guys because Tiny Engines released your first LP, am I correct?
Yeah.
So I think it was Fest 2011 and you guys were playing, totally blanking on the venue, Common Grounds, I think. Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, I think so.
And you guys were, you know, you guys were playing a little bit later in the evening. It was one of those things I wanted to see you and I was there. I don't know, it just kind of shocked me because for one, I didn't expect anybody to give a shit about you, but they did. And and two, I don't know, I guess for lack of a better term, just kind of like togetherness, professionalism, like the show that you guys put on wasn't necessarily indicative of the venue that you were playing. Like you guys could have been playing, you know, whatever, a, you know, Union Transfer or whatever. Like you could have, I felt like you guys were filling a larger stage than what you were playing. And I know it's funny because I was just in preparing research for this. I've noticed that you've pointed to that particular fest as being kind of like a turning point for you mentally, as far as like you were saying, like, oh wow, people like really care about us. Or was that the previous year that you kind of felt like
the previous year was the first one? And that was like our first tour. I mean, we hadn't really done much at all. I think we'd gone down like maybe as far as like North Carolina, because we ended up going down with Look Mexico and Red Collar. And we're like, oh, this is cool. Like, good bands want to tour with us. This is awesome. And so, like, you know, playing those shows and like, the shows were okay, but we got down to Fest and it was like this massive, crazy thing. We played at Lucy's, which is like the pretty small venue. It's like maybe like 100, 200 people tops. Mm-hmm. And we really, you know, we were playing it like, it was getting up there on like Sunday. Like,
right.
There's no way anybody's coming to the show. And it just kind of happened. I don't know how else to explain it other than that. But a bunch of people that like had known us or had never seen us before showed up, and a bunch of people that had never heard of us before just took a gamble on the show and just ended up there, and it just became this thing. But yeah, by the time we played that Common Ground show, it was just like, oh shit, like this is, you know, that final year, like we just kind of picked up with things with Side One and got the new record together. And you know, it was just this whole like, that by the time we got to that Common Ground show, it was just like I felt like we'd finally figured out how to be a band.
Yeah you felt like you were prepared for whatever was going to be put in front of you.
Yeah, it was very much like, we need a set list. We have to like,
you know, right.
Do this. We can't just like show up and like play for our friends and get drunk.
This should be taken a little more seriously.
Yeah.
And kind of alluding to the press cycle as well, because I always try to identify sort of the tropes that get placed on bands and musicians of like, the, you know, either the common questions or the common, you know, descriptors that people put on a band. And I obviously try to, you know, subvert that in some capacity. The thing that I've seen placed on you guys nonstop for every single record is like, dude, you guys can't describe yourselves. Like, you're not a punk band. You're not a rock band. Like, you don't belong anywhere. How do you describe your sound? To me, I've always listened to it. It's like, I don't know. It just seems like a logical extension for what you personally have kind of been doing musically, where it's like all you're doing is adding nuance and, like you said, more professionalism over time. Is that accurate reflection of kind of the way that you look at what you're doing with restorations?
The way people talk about it sometimes is like they've never heard guitar music before. Like, right. They've never heard like a rock band ever. Like, you're like, how have you never heard like, I don't know, like U2? Like, what are you? Like,
right.
Like, it's like pretty big, obvious influences that are going on in our band. And you know, we all like our own fair share of like obscure, like really smart, you know, dense music or whatever. But, you know, for the most part, like nothing that's happening in our band is like particularly like crazy or huge. Or, like, you know, so you read some interviews or some reviews and stuff sometimes, and you're like, wow, you guys just only listen to like Latterman and that's it. Like, that's right. Like, you just have never heard any other bands.
It definitely is a lot that can be said about, I guess, the way that a person obviously describes. Because, like, I listened to like your earlier stuff and I'm like, oh yeah, they got a little bit like, you know, maybe like a heavier Hold Steady. Like, that's kind of like what I would describe it as. And it's like, I find that I'm not like taking shots at people, but just like laziness of like, man, you guys are undefinable.
It's, yeah.
Like, right. Are you really?
Yeah.
And I presume that's obviously like what you're always saying, where it's like, I don't know if we're really undefinable.
We just, our structures are a little different, but it's not like anything that, I don't know. It's just funny to me.
Yeah, no, for sure. You yourself, or you were born and raised in Jersey, yeah?
I was born in Philadelphia and moved to Jersey for up until I was 18, and then I moved back to Philly. My parents split up, so my dad was in Philly, my mom was in Jersey.
Ah, got it.
So yeah, and then I've been here ever since.
Okay, yeah, you cannot be more Philadelphia at all.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I was born Northeast.
Would you say your formative years you were spending more? When I say formative, I mean like, you know, junior high and high school and stuff like that. Were you more in Jersey or Philly?
A little bit of both. I mean, okay. As far as shows go, anyway, like there was a lot of like driving, getting rides, taking trains to Philly to see shows, and then to like Asbury to see shows, and. That was like a big thing growing up, was just kind of like getting out of the crappy central Jersey town I was in.
What crappy central Jersey town were you in?
I was a suburb of Trenton.
Well, the typical question is, what exit off the turnpike?
I actually don't even remember. I didn't start driving till I left.
That's true. So you would be like, I don't know.
Yeah, middle of nowhere.
And so what was your family structure like as you were growing up and kind of before your parents split?
Oh, it was good, man. Both my parents have been really supportive, and you know, I kind of have like a boring childhood that way, where it's just kind of like everything was just all right.
Yeah.
Both my parents are like super encouraging about playing music and being into music, and you know, as abrasive as it was at the time, or right. You know, whatever. It was always like, you know, go check it out, you know?
Yeah. Do you have brothers and sisters too?
I do have one little brother who's also a musician.
Okay. Oh, wow. Your parents must have been just like, oh, why are you guys dedicating this life to music?
Yeah, it was pretty great. Well, my mom is like a classical pianist. She did tons of schooling for that and taught for a number of years, and she's like a choral music kind of person. And then my dad played guitar, and you know, loved you know, 60s and 70s rock and stuff. So that was like a big introduction for me growing up, was like basically like classical music and Styx and Paul Simon.
Okay. Styx and Paul Simon.
Yeah.
I love those sort of like early inflection points in your own musical life.
That's
where
great.
It's like, yeah, because you like it obviously comes from such an innocent place, and it's usually obviously in part to your parents. And, you know, sometimes our parents aren't like steeped in any one specific culture. They're just listening to music because they tripped on it.
Yep. Totally. Yeah. They were just sort of like into whatever. And it was kind of great that way, because it was less, you know, it was just music, you know, there's nothing else to it. It's just like, oh yeah, cool. There's this Billy Joel record. Like, that's what we're going to listen to now.
Yeah. No, totally. I just have such a distinct memory in my own childhood of like the Phantom of the Opera soundtrack. And that is I could listen to that today and still probably tear up because again, it just comes from such like an innocent place. And my mom was playing it in the car, and it was like, oh yeah, of course, dude, Andrew Lloyd Webber, he fucks some shit up.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's funny too, like I talk about this in interviews a fair amount, but like, you know, the big record for me growing up was Styx Paradise Theater. That was like the first rock and roll record I heard.
Yeah.
Like in, you know, 1985 or whatever it was,
right.
I just remember my dad putting it on like the vinyl, you know. So I just have this like thing ingrained in me, like, oh man, like huge guitar rock with, you know, solos and organ and, and like immediately was like, this is what I've been looking for forever, my, you know, my whole 3 years being alive.
Right. You're like, oh, this obviously defines me.
Yeah, right. And it's kind of in a comedic sense, I guess, sort of followed me around ever since.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, you could look at that record being really important to you, and then being like, I mean, I see why it is, but like that, obviously that doesn't score me any credibility points.
Yeah, no way. It was one of the funniest records I've ever heard, like coming back to it, but.
Yeah. And so then, so you said your mom was teaching piano. What does your dad do for work?
My dad's an IT guy now, but you know, he's just always like music on in the car, music on at home. You know, always played guitar growing up. You know, got me my first guitar, that sort of thing. You know, he would come see my shitty punk band play shows. You know, like he was always just sort of like super encouraging and making as much music available as, you know, he could figure out.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to like get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit betterhelp.com/Ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/Ray.
Check the backseat. Check the backseat. Check the backseat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Hey, it's Zuko and Kayla from The Wake Up Call. Enjoy your podcast, but when you're done, don't forget about us. We have a radio show. We try to bring a smile to your face every morning.
We also talk to some of the hottest country stars of today, and we like to share some good news with That's What I Like.
Because Lord knows that's hard to find. When you're done podcasting your podcast, listen to us at 92.3 WCOL.
Set your preset on your radio right now, and don't forget you can listen to us online on the iHeartRadio app.
Because I presume you obviously invited him out to your show. Like, hey, Dad.
Oh,
come
totally.
To this.
Yeah, yeah.
And what was his impression? Like, did he walk away being like, wow, like that was cool, or I didn't know you had that in you, or how
yeah,
did he
react? I think that's kind of how it went. He's just, you know, stoked. I think music is music, and you know, not that he's like a big like hardcore guy or anything, but he gets it, you know, and he's totally then like not. He's not very dadly about it. It's just sort of like, you know, totally seems to understand the whole thing. And, you know, we started touring and stuff and, you know, both my parents were just kind of like, you know, go get him. Like,
wow,
fuck shit up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's great. I mean, it sounds like the environment was ripe for you being able to completely dive obviously into independent music and just kind of like, you know, have that openness where your parents weren't like obviously, you know, throwing away your records or trying to tell you can't go to a show or anything like that.
Yeah, I lucked out. I didn't get too many of those like, so when are you gonna get a job kind of talks, you know?
Well, that's good. that's very good.
I managed to escape, which is cool.
Yeah, no, that's really cool.
And then yeah, and it's, you know, especially now that we're a different level than we were before, it's like you get a little bit more of a sense of like, oh cool, well this is worth it, like congrats. Like there's not so much I don't know. You talk to a lot of other musicians and it seems like it's a little more contentious.
Oh, sure. Yeah. There's that level of, I mean, I don't want to say judgment because it's like anybody that it's like, I mean, as you being a grown ass man and me being a grown ass man, we can look at the decisions that we made to play bands and do stupid stuff as being like, well, yeah, any parent would be like, dude, I don't know about that.
And I was always into like art and music, and I don't think there was like really ever any expectation I was going to like go to business school or anything. So right. I think they're just stoked I'm happy, and that's kind of where it is.
Yeah, you're like, I've paved this road for a long time. You I'm not diverting expectations.
Yeah, pretty much.
So what kind of kid did you find yourself being like as you started? I guess maybe prior to the sort of, you know, inception of kind of independent music in your life. What did you find yourself being? Like you said, you're always into art. Were you kind of the proverbial indoor kid, or were you into?
Oh yeah, totally, man.
Okay.
Totally, yeah. I was like typical awful suburban kid. You know, like I spent a lot of time in the mall, like listening to ska, like
nice,
like absolutely like down to a T, like absolutely the worst.
just a total mall rat hanging out the local arcade.
Totally, and like I got some good stuff, like, you know, and I got into some really awful stuff, and it wasn't until I got into college really that everything totally clicked. Like Jeff from Jenner Berlin and some of those earlier Restorations records. I met around the first year or two of college, I guess. First year of college, actually. And that's how I met Dave and a bunch of other people that we've played in bands with forever. Mm-hmm. And all those guys were a little bit more ingrained ingrained in the Philly scene. Like Jeff used to book at like the Kill Time and stuff like that. And
didn't Jeff also book at, cause I remember, I knew you played in Jenner Berlin, but I remember meeting Jeff. Cause didn't he book shows at like Temple for a little bit? Like,
yeah. Yeah. And that was it for us, man. That Temple was like the biggest thing in the world. Cause we had like a ton of money to like pay out of town bands. And then we could like play shows and put our friends' bands on these like really on all these shows that like nobody belonged to be on.
Right. Right.
You know, we were that college crew.
Yeah, no, I remember. Then we played together because my old band Taken played with Seosin there.
Son of a bitch! Yeah, Jeff definitely did that show.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know you were in Taken. That's really funny.
Yeah, no, I sang for the band. I remember that show being so incredible because it was just like, I mean, there's already a lot of people there, obviously checking out Seosin, but it was like, you know, I usually college shows are obviously not entirely professional, but when you meet a person that knows what they're doing and you're just like, oh, this is how a college show is supposed to be run.
Yo, that was awesome. And Jeff really because, you know, Jeff played in band. Jeff and Dave grew up together. Dave, our guitar player. And those dudes had played in bands forever and, you know, basement shows, whatever. Like they'd done it. Sort of the same thing, like grew up in the suburbs and just escaped and like started doing shows and playing in bands. So, like by the time the college came around, Jeff figured it out somehow that there was like a college like fund for like the school group, you know? And he was just like, oh shit, I could pay like thrice, like $500 to come play here. Like, great, let's do it. Like, you know, everybody on it. And,
right.
But people came out. Like this is like the thing that was crazy about it was like, you would have like 300 people come see like Bear versus Shark at the
Owl Cove.
Owl Cove. That's the one.
That I literally hadn't thought about that until it was just like, wait, Temple, Owl Cove. Yeah.
Totally, man. But I mean, we played with so many bad hardcore shows and like just had so many bands come through, and that was like the central hub. And that was everybody we met through that basically like helped us out on tour once we got out of college. Like when we were done at Temple, like we were, you know, we'd be like, oh, this is these people we met in New York, like what's up? And they would bring us up there and we'd go out and around. And that was really the only way that we got out.
Yeah.
Was because of that whole thing. It was a really fortunate, again, it's sort of like a luck thing to sort of meet these dudes and get involved in that. But it was just like lights going on. It was just like, oh my God, I understand it now. Like, cause before everything was like, so, you know, mystical and like secret and crazy. Now it's like, oh, I get it. This is really easy. Anybody can do this. This is awesome. Like punk.
Right. Cool. Right. Right. So was Jenner Berlin your first band?
Yeah. Yeah. I'd never been in a band before. It's like I said, I'd always been interested in music and, you know, played and whatever, but I was never in like an actual band that like did shit. So that was a huge thing for me because those guys had already been in bands for forever.
Right.
So like, you know, I'm like this awful kid out of the suburbs, like freshly into college with this like really great opportunity. And I'm just, I really spent a long time like doing the wrong thing and learning in that band. It was really cool.
Yeah. You're able to hitch your wagon to someone with some experience in order to kind of, you know, maybe push you past the first, you know, whatever, first 10 awful mistakes you make when you start a 16-year-old band or whatever.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, we started that band in like 02 or 03, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We really spent a while being really awful.
Yeah.
But towards the end, we had it together and kind of had some steam. But by then it was just like, it was too late for that band. But
yeah. Well, it's so hard too, because it's like, especially when you've been, you know, kind of, like you said, you've been kind of at it for, you know, 5 to 6 years, then it starts to, you know, the crushing realities of life and making money and all these other things come into play. And it's like, oh man, like, can we gear up to like do, you know, this small thing again? I don't know if we can do this.
It worked out kind of nicely though, because it's like if JB was like grad school in a way that, you know, we took everything we learned from that, and I feel like restoration is like my first like good job.
Right, right.
Like really focused on like not blowing it at this point.
Right, right. No, I like that. I got a good
boss, you know?
Right. I've never viewed bands from the lens of obviously like a schooling perspective, but yeah, it totally makes sense what you're talking about.
Yeah. Spend a lot of time making really awful work and then, you know, have no idea what you're doing right after. So
right.
Beautiful thing.
Yeah. And so like you said, independent music kind of didn't start popping up until you were in college. So obviously you had some sort of, well, for lack of a better term, like path, so to speak. Like what were you trying to set yourself up to be as a working professional? Or was it always just like, well, whatever I do, I'm just gonna try to still do music always?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I kind of got lucky there too, and I that's probably why I bring up the zine thing too, is I was working for Wonka Vision, if you remember that from back in the day.
Oh, dude, Justin, of course.
Yeah, so I was the art director there for a long time.
Oh, okay.
Along that's with right. Bruno Guerrero, who's the guy that does all of our artwork.
That's awesome.
Two of us kind of did the art angle of that for a number of years coming out of, or like halfway through college, or very Temple centric, obviously, because it was those Owls Cove shows. And like, it was like Jeff was one of the editors and Dave was writing for them. And, you know, we were kind of like making that thing haul along for a little while till that went to shit. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, me and Bruno got a gig working for Decibel Magazine here in Philly too. Everything was kind of all tied in together through that. So I was sort of just touring and playing shows and, you know, working on this magazine. And I don't know, it just became this thing where like everything sort of started to work together a little.
Yeah.
But then like JB kind of went into outer space, and that last like, 2 years where we were doing like way, way too much touring to keep like a normal job. So I got fired from Decibel, and WonkaVision kind of collapsed there towards the end.
Yeah. That was when Justin had by that time moved to Denver. I remember that.
Yeah. Fuck, man.
I know.
Some real shit in there.
Dude, for sure. I remember because Taken stayed with him in Denver, and I just remember because I contributed occasionally to Wonka Vision, just like reviews or whatever. Justin,
that's probably why I remember your name.
Right. Yeah.
Starting there.
I just remember being like, "Hey, Justin, what's happening with Wonka Vision?" And it was kind of like he basically just ignored my question. I was like, "Oh," and I can't remember what year that was, but it was probably around the
2007.
Maybe it was even a little bit earlier. But I don't know, whatever. It's irrelevant to people that don't remember early 2000 zines.
Yeah. So it was an early 2000 zine for people that don't know who it is, it's an early 2000 zine that like turned into like a national publication and then immediately went under. It's sort of the same thing where like we really like did a bad job for a while. Like met a lot of really interesting people and like eventually learned how to do it the right way.
Right.
And now I have this like really good job in publishing. I come and go and do interesting stuff, and I'm really lucky to have that now. It's been a pretty cool transition.
So I mean, I'll be backing up, but like, so what is your current position within the publishing industry, as it were?
So currently I work for Random Embassy in Philly. It's actually this dude Tony used to go to Temple Hardcore shows.
isn't that always the case where you're just like. And especially too, from like a professional standpoint, when you meet a person that has that kind of like undercurrent of experience that you've come from, like there's such a shorthand where you're just like, oh yeah, dude, of course you could work for me. Of course. Like, sure. Yeah. Let's sign you up.
Yep. That's my boss is Philly Hardcore. Yeah. It's just funny. It goes kind of deep now, I guess. But, So it's me and Tony, we make books for, books and small magazines, brochures, annual reports, that kind of stuff for a lot of like nonprofits and art galleries, and we work for the city. But it's a really cool gig. We just get to kind of, you know, we like have our space that we work out of.
Make cool stuff.
Yeah. But you know, I've realized that like I can sometimes be just as effective on a laptop in Australia as I am here. And you can plan accordingly so that it's, you know, everybody kind of knows what's up, but it's, if you balance it out, you know, do everything on your own terms and make sure that everybody gets taken care of, like there's no problem.
So, yeah.
at this point, I finally figured out how to make everything balance out, and it's crazy that it all works, but that's my job right now. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, no, that's really rad. I mean, that's the ideal scenario that most people want to be in, where it's like, especially if you're in a touring band, to be able to be like, oh yeah, I have a job that obviously supports my life, but then at the same time, it's not impeding my creative process as well.
Yeah, and it's cool because it's like it's good work, and it's for good places, and it like has like a purpose, like the things we put out are a function. It's not just like stuff that gets tossed immediately,
right? Yeah. It's altruistic in nature as well, in some capacities, I'm sure.
Yeah, so I don't really feel like I'm like burning myself out too much between tours, or you know, when we have downtime, it's just like I'm just working on something else. Like some days I'm playing shows, some days I'm, you know, working on a book. It just sort of shifts, and it keeps everything really fresh and interesting. And even the band stuff too, it's like, oh, we're going on tour, it's like no longer annoying for me. It's just a nice change of pace. It's just a different job for the week.
So congratulations, I'm glad.
Thanks. That took a long time. Still got a lot to do, but you know,
a question that, you know, I myself always get, where it's just like, you know, from people either knowing my past experience of like, you know, whatever, working at record labels and still being able to tour, and just kind of like, how do you do that? And it's like, well, for one, you just kind of like work hard with the idea of like, okay, I need to find some job in some field that is hopefully tangentially related to the sort of music that I'm trying to create that will hopefully be able to afford the lifestyle that I want to live, like, you know, in touring and stuff like that. And it's like, sometimes you just have to, like, you know, I know this sounds very sort of pie in the sky, but just kind of like, you know, make your own destiny in a way where it's like, you know, you doing everything within, you know, Wonka Vision and Decibel and stuff like that, you know, all those I'm sure in some respects were like happenstance, but then that was able to lead you to where you're at now.
Yeah. And it's just because I just sort of kept pursuing stuff that was interesting to me, you know, at the time, like, you know, I met a bunch of guys that worked at a screen shop, and this was sort of like the next step after all that stuff happened, where I was working in a screen shop for a really long time, printing shirts and making posters and doing all that. And that was just sort of like, I knew people that did it and I thought it was really interesting. So I got involved and I ended up working there for a little while. Met some other people, and, you know, it's, everything sort of leads to another, and it, that sort of like keeping your eyes open, like punk rock hustle is pretty much how it works. You know, it's like, if you know, you like a band or some scene or a place you want to go, you know, find people that live there and go talk to them, go find that, you know, pick up, yeah, things from around there and just, you know, get an idea of the landscape. And yeah, you know, you got to get lucky with that too. It's not all so direct. Over time it worked out.
Yeah, for sure. And as long as you're making yourself, I think the biggest thing is obviously making yourself, in some sense of the term, like, obviously professional and competent. Because, like, I mean, as you well know, those qualities don't exactly embody themselves in a lot of people on a regular basis. And when, sure, if you could present yourself with those two qualities, it's like, oh yeah, like, you know what you're doing.
Yeah, totally.
And so then as you started to, you know, whatever, graduate high school, did you go to Temple then, obviously?
Yeah, I went to Tyler, the art school at Temple.
Oh, okay.
I went full on.
When you say art, when you were you studying just different mediums, or was it all obviously like dedicated towards the digital and print medium that you were obviously, you know, working in?
Yeah, I went in blind, just, you know, being like, I could paint or whatever, I don't care, just art stuff is fine. And went to Italy on that study abroad thing, came back my freshman year, was like really big into posters and printed medium, like little books and zines and that sort of thing. And that was all like super appealing to me. And then that was like right when I met Jeff, right when I found out about Wonka Vision, right when all that stuff clicked in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I went right into graphic design right after that, just being like, oh, I could work for a music magazine and just retire. This will be great.
Worked
for music magazines forever and realized it was awful. But that was like the initial path for me, was just being like, oh man, if I could just make like a poster that hangs in the electric factory, that'd be awesome.
You're like, I'm done at that
point. Yeah, right. So here I am in retirement.
Yeah, here you are. Well, I'm really glad I can talk to you.
Rich and fulfilled, yeah.
Right. I'm glad I can talk to Millionaire John Loudon. Thank you for your time.
It's been great.
So you said your parents split up, and obviously you went to Philly. So when did your parents divorce? Like, well, how old were you?
I was in the first grade. So it was pretty like not weird to have my parents split up, because it was just most of my life. That's the way it was.
Right, right.
So yeah, it was a long, long time ago now.
I presume, did it have, you know, any sort of resonance or long lasting effect on you in regards to, you know, how the way you viewed your, I guess, relationships at large, or either the relationship with your mother or father?
The only thing that I really got good at through that was just traveling. And I think that was the big thing, was like bouncing back and forth all the time and going to see new places and, you know, meeting new family over the years. And, you know, that was kind of a big thing. There's a lot of road trips, a lot of listening to records over long periods of time with nothing, and moving around, that sort of stuff. And that sort of like set the rhythm, I think, for what I'm doing now.
Right.
I don't know. It wasn't too strange. It's like I said, I was so young, it kind of didn't even matter.
Yeah. It didn't, you weren't able to probably process it. You were just like, oh, this is the way that things are now.
Yeah. Right. Like, obviously a bummer, but it wasn't like crippling or whatever.
I mean, you yourself strike me as like, you could probably live on the West Coast and kind of blend in. Like, you seem like a very laid back dude. Like, but I know that in previous interviews that you've kind of mentioned that you know, you're an anxious person. I'm sure obviously the copious amounts of coffee that you consume obviously doesn't help that. But, you know, where, so do you define yourself obviously as an anxious person, and where does that kind of, you know, sort of derive from, if you've been able to, identify it in some capacity?
It's more so that I just feel like I always have to be busy and involved in things, and I'm always planning and like working on something. I've always got some kind of, you know, bad idea or something I'm working on that I'm trying to pursue.
Okay.
And like, I don't know. Yeah. I very much could like just move to the coast and be fine with it.
Right.
I do enjoy a little bit of downtime. Yeah. I kind of go back and forth, I guess. a little bit of both.
So is it maybe a better way of defining it, at least in the way that you're describing it, would be like, is it a kind of like restlessness where you just always feel like you got to have like seven irons in the fire in order to feel like you're productive?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it, you know, after so many years of freelancing and just sort of scraping by, I mean, it was real touch and go for a number of years. With everything kind of settling in a little bit in the past couple of years. Uh-huh. But yeah, so, like just having to like hustle all the time, like right. always be working on something. And it's like, you know, now that things are just like pretty okay the whole way around, I'm still like, oh God, I got to work on this thing. I get this shit together. Like uh-huh. I get real scrambly.
Right. Scrambly. So when it was its quote unquote darkest, where you were obviously like barely scraping by, you know, was there ever that moment where you were just like, yo dude, I got to fucking realign. Like I gotta get out of this, all this stuff. Like, you know, that sort of like scorched earth mentality of like everything that I've known, I need to do the opposite of that. Or did you just kind of like, well, hopefully eventually it'll get better.
I almost moved, I guess, kind of at the end of that. Like Jennifer was sort of at full tilt. I was living on the floor of a warehouse, which is really cool.
Right.
Like not in a room, like just on the floor. I was like, a two level, like practice space kind of thing in a giant warehouse. I was like sleeping on top of one of the practice spaces. You know, no heat or air conditioning or anything. And then working in the screen shop in the front of it, just touring like all the fucking time, just like, you know, 200 days a year or whatever. It got to a certain point where it was like, we were playing like the same basement show over and over and over and over and over again. And like, not that we really had expectations of anything getting like big or anything, but you know, at a certain point you've played in hardcore bands. Like, you know, at a certain point you're just sort of like, oh, fuck, what the fuck am I doing? Like,
oh, yeah.
There's no, like, this doesn't go anywhere. Nothing happens. You don't like affect any real change. Nobody really gives a shit. There's no like broader conversation that happens after a certain point. It was after a certain point where like when everyone you know that plays in a band gets to like go do something bigger and you're just like fish out of water. Mm-hmm. You're just like, oh, we don't really have to do this anymore, do we? Like, there's nothing more to do. And luckily at this point this is really stupid. Looking back on it, it was totally idiotic to do it this way. But we had a number of like bass players and second guitar players were out of state that we'd either have to like fly in or whatever. And we'd flown our new bass player with us to Europe for our first tour over there.
Right.
And came back. And I just moved into a new place with some friends. Had a little bit of work for the first time ever. And we were kind of just like, yo, I'm done with this. I'm done. Like, we had nowhere to practice. We had, you know, barely had any gear, like didn't have a full band. We like, you know, weren't writing a record we were happy with. And at this little like couple month window, I guess, me and Jeff and Dave started jamming on some other material that just wasn't for that band. And that's kind of what became that first restoration, sort of us chilling out a little bit and being like, yeah, maybe we'll just play locally, you know, until the next big Jenner Berlin tour comes along. We'll just play these songs. Like at the Kyber, like it'll be fun. We can hang out. And I was super into like Constantine's and Hold City and stuff like that, like G chord punk at the time. And kind of just wound down and fell into this like really good groove of like, oh, I like working. I like living in a place that has like walls.
Right.
Like, you know, I like seeing my friends all the time.
Right.
You know, I kind of got over this thing where I was just like about to like leave town because everything was awful and just sort of like started settling in a little bit and like getting more involved. And, that just changed everything over. And that kind of, I think if it sounds like there was like a really serious change in tone between that last JB EP and then like the first restorations recordings, is because it was just like this like switch, you know, everything just kind of like lined up.
Check the backseat. Check the backseat.
All right, come here.
Check the backseat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
It's the Breakfast Club, the world's most dangerous morning show.
Hey!
Angela Yee is kind of like the big sister that always pokes you in the forehead.
Ooh. That's not how it goes?
That's not how anything goes.
Yimby's really like a robot. One of the best DJs ever.
Believe that!
Charlamagne is the wild card.
And I'm about to give somebody the credit they deserve for being stupid.
I know, that's right.
What is wrong with you?
Listen to the Breakfast Club weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on 106.7 The Beat, Columbus's real hip-hop and R&B.
Well, it's funny because this was something I was going to ask you or bring up a little bit later. It's something that you only experience, obviously, when a person like with your experiences in regards to, you know, doing bands, like in multiple bands, and like obviously with the, you know, the proverbial eye on the prize, and not like you were talking about in some sort of like, oh, dude, I can't wait to, you know, be as big as whatever, a day to remember, whatever, you know.
Yeah, right.
Or rise against. You find that when you like, here, I'll use an example in my own life that I know it'll probably ring true for you, where it was like, okay, Taken had broke up in about 2004. And mm-hmm. then I immediately picked up and started playing in a new band called Makoto. And we were around.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So I sang for that, but it was such a weird thing because I can only retrospectively look at that band, and there are elements of it that I am proud of, but basically, for lack of a better term, we were trying too hard. We were basically playing to, you know, kind of appease whatever was happening in music at that time. Like, yes, mm-hmm. of course, we were being authentic with our art in the songs that we were creating, but we definitely had a mindset of being like, all right, we're going to use our experiences, you know, be able to just absolutely kill it. Yeah. And so, but then ultimately it's like no one cared.
Yeah.
And it was. And so you do run into that experience of exactly what you're talking about in the shift between Jennifer Lynn and Restorations, where you at that point had stopped trying. All of a sudden, this really unique and authentic thing started to come from you. And then obviously look where you're at with Restorations now. And it's like, that's such a hard point to arrive to, you know?
Totally. It was pretty much just like giving up entirely on it. Just being like, we're good. I've seen all the things I'm going to see. Like, you know, we can bar band it now. It's time. Like, we can do this, and, right. you know? And like that went from like my main priority to just like something I did every once in a while. And in doing that, like, I just really enjoyed it for a while. Just there's something really nice about just going in every week or two and hanging out with your friends and, you know, making stuff that you actually like with the intent of just putting out records, or just, you know, one day putting out a 7-inch or something, like having like the craft angle on it rather than like, all right, we're going to get on this tour and we're going to go talk to these booking agents and we're going to, you know, like right. getting all of that stuff together. It was like, you know, the big thing that we were all trying to get next rather than like just making stuff that we liked. Not that we don't like the stuff that we put out, but, you know, it really affects like where your brain is at the time. And especially then, you know, we had like literally no money. I'm not well off now, but you know, when we actually had no money, like some of us didn't have anywhere to live and that sort of thing was, you know, it really clouds what your intentions are and like where you're going is always a little skewed that way.
Yeah, no, I think there's in something that you're talking about right there. I think there's clearly an element of desperation, and obviously using that desperation as kind of a leaping off point for you know, art or music in general, it can go one of two ways. Desperation from the sense of where it goes one way of like, all right, here's this really sort of pseudo contrived music that we are trying to do because we are trying to, whatever, like you said, put yourself in a more stable position. Or there's that, obviously there's the flip side where it's like, yeah, you create some, you know, whatever, the first Bon Iver record where it's like this tortured piece of art that everyone is like, oh my God, it's, you know, it's the best thing ever. I could see what you're talking about. I never really thought about it in this sense of being desperate. You know, and not in like a, yeah, not in a pejorative sense, but just a desperate, like, fuck, I don't have anywhere to live, like you said.
Yeah, you just start getting really good at all this awful stuff. Like, you're eating terribly, you're not living in a safe place, you're not like, you don't have time to like have good friends, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's all this stuff starts to coalesce, you know, and you pick up a job you hate. You know, those sorts of things. It just becomes like this really unhealthy environment. Some people get stuck in that too. It's really fucked. Like some, you know, some band people, like if, you know, stuff doesn't work out or whatever, it's like they just keep this shitty lifestyle they were living while they were touring, and you're like, oh, this is awful. Like, this is a terrible way to live.
And so then obviously as Restoration started to, you know, go out there, and it's like, I think the first time that I listened to you prior to the, did the split that you guys did with Rosetta, that came out before the first LP, or was that after? I can't recall.
I think that was before the first LP came out.
Okay.
We'd switched members. Jeff had gone on to do some like more booking stuff. And that was sort of the thing, was like, you know, we'd all, when that was done, we kind of all pursued like other stuff for a little while. And Jeff got really heavy into booking and looking and starting a venue and that kind of stuff. And you know, we were talking about doing like, I don't know, like a week tour or something, and he's like, I can't fucking do this anymore, I'm out.
Right.
You know, like me and Jeff share the same fear of touring, of like, oh God, we're gonna be doing this thing where we just play to nobody forever and it's gonna be awful. And
yeah,
I guess that's maybe even Dave's default setting still. But I remember we were talking about like, oh, we're going to do some shows. And Jeff was just like, I can't fucking do it. I'm out.
And, right.
And he was just busy at the time, I guess. I don't know.
Right. Or there is something to be said when you obviously experience tour after tour of playing, you know, in front of whatever 15 to 20 people a night, of like, of getting yourself in that headspace of like, okay, this is what I could expect. And then like, even if it's, you know, if it's 10 people, that it feels crushing where you're just like, I wanted at least 20. Like, you know?
Right. You start like making these arbitrary goals. I think the biggest thing, and we've talked about this within the band a bunch, like the biggest bummer about touring that way wasn't that you're playing like 20 people a night. It's that when you come back, those 20 people aren't there. And so it's like, you can play a show and you feel like you've just collapsed this house, where you're like, oh man, we crushed, this was great, we had such a good time, we sold like 5 records, this is fantastic, like, oh god, right. I can't wait to come back to Missoula. And you go back there and it's no one that you met first time is there, the house is gone, like, you know, or the bar you played is closed, it, like, people have moved, you know.
right.
And you're just like, oh shit, this sucks. And then like you do that for like 6 years in a row and you're just like, I'm good, I get it, like,
right.
Like, that's the part that really becomes kind of dark after a while. It's like, you know, like if punk's like about building community and whatever, like then when you to watch that start to go away within the punk scene that you've tried so hard to, you know, contribute to, it gets real intense after a while.
Yeah. I know that there is a blueprint for this thing, but I like, we can't even get that blueprint to work of like getting those, like you said, those 20 people to show up next time, because they've obviously moved on.
Yeah.
And so then, like you said, or like we were talking about earlier in regards to, you know, the first fest tour as being kind of a realignment in your perspective. And then now obviously sitting where you're at currently, is it one of those things that you find yourself kind of constantly trying to either check your aspirations or check your expectations of like what the band can kind of achieve? Or do you have that sort of like that drive of pushing more that can sometimes be, you know, can lead you astray?
I think at this point, you know, I don't think anybody expects to be like selling out Wembley or anything anytime soon, but we're just enjoying the ride. I think we have so many resources now that were totally unavailable to us the entire time last time around.
Right.
You know, just to have the help and like the reassurance and just, you know, the safety net, I guess, of having like, you know, we have 10 people at the record label that help us out all the time. You know, our manager does quite a bit of work for us. Also Philly hardcore dude. You know, we have a really good booking agent, you know, it's all this stuff that I would have shunned years ago. I've like learned how to work with. It's just been awesome. We've gotten to do all this really cool shit. And like every time we go out is a little bit better than the last. And, you know, it's like I said, I'm not rich on this, but we're, you know, not
things are
stealing
building.
Vans either, you know, like we can like pay our van rental.
Right. And so tell me, you mentioned like the, you know, resistant to ideas. And I definitely think, I like to paint that the picture of context appropriately for those feelings of like, yo, dude, managers are evil. And like, man, I don't know. Like, cause that all is, I mean, that sentiment is lost now. Just because it's such a common practice, and and obviously since our music scene has become, for lack of a better term, like more credible. Just like, you know, hey, you know, Johnny Two Bags down the street wants to quote unquote manage your band. You're like, what the fuck are you talking? Right.
But, totally.
So when did you, you know, when did it become comfortable for you, or what sort of wrestling process did you go on with your own, in your own head in regards to like, oh, is this, I don't know, is this the right move or whatever?
I mean, I think that was sort of the thing, like if a lot of the idea with this is like that it causes us less stress day to day, you know, like we can sign with a bigger label and it's, you know, it works out well. We're not like, it takes care of stuff that we either weren't good at or don't want to do. And like, that's just made everything so much simpler. And, you know, you start looking at things like, oh yeah, I don't want to sit in front of my computer all day for a month writing people that aren't going to write me back. Like, I'm going to get a booking agent that like knows how to do this and will be there every day in front of his computer writing people. Then maybe won't write him back either, but you know, like,
right.
It's just like, there's like all the really monotonous, intense stuff that I just hate and I don't want to deal with at all, that other people are much better at. If you find people that know what you want to do and aren't going to push you to do stuff you don't want to do, that you can sort of like make that stuff work. It's like a small business at this point with us, where it's just like, oh yeah, cool. Like, oh, we could use an accountant. Like, we should get an accountant. It's that kind of thing where you're just like, I don't want to do my taxes. Like, you do my taxes. I can give you, you know, $50. We're good.
Right. It's like, it becomes practical as opposed to like, oh, here's this ecosystem of the man that we don't want to be a part of, you know?
Yeah. And the discussion becomes kind of ridiculous. It's like, you know, I don't want to print my own t-shirts. I know how to do it. I send it to the print shop. It's the same thing, you know, like a lot of that is kind of it's a goofy discussion to have.
Yeah.
But for us, it's cool because, you know, we've gotten to the point now where it's like, you know, I have lots of stuff that I do in my life that I really enjoy. And, you know, if me being in a band is like getting to travel and make music and, you know, talk to people, like that's what I want out of the experience. I don't really want to deal with the rest of it. And, I'm fortunate enough at this point that we, you know, have people that like worry about like, you know, when our record's late, they can like talk to the plant a couple of times a week and work it out. You know, right. That's like off my desk, and it's more time I'm spending like writing songs or working or hanging out with my family and friends.
Right.
We're super, super lucky that way. But I mean, it's 31. I have a full-time job. If you're going to do it here, like you have to be really, really smart about it, and you have to delegate, and you have to have like an army of people behind you. It's the only way it works. Some of us own houses and are married and have, you know, other really intense full-time jobs and stuff you'd scoff at when you're like 22, but you know, 10 years later, you're just like, oh yeah, this is the only way to go.
Right. Yeah. It's like this, oh, this is practical. Like we were talking about.
Yeah.
I think something that there's two last things I wanted to hit on were clearly restorations and like the, for lack of a better term, if I'm using, you know, business-like terms where it's like your guys's target demographic when you started to create the music was obviously not being like, all right, man, we are going to capture the 14 to 18 year old market. Like no problem.
Yeah, right.
Like it was clearly just from listening to it, you know, all your stuff. It's like, it was never meant to capture that market. And you obviously played to, for lack of a better term, like an older fan base. And I presume that was just a function of what you guys were writing rather than like, oh, well, like let's see if we can play to that crowd, so to speak.
Yeah, completely. I mean, we, at the time it was like, you know, we just sort of write what we want and see what happens. And, it was kind of funny, you know, a lot of our friends at the time, especially were like late 20s teachers and, graphic designers and stuff like that. You know, like the typical, like the NPR crowd for context's sake, you start to realize that like when you, this is a big thing with the fest shows, like you leave town and you find people that like are coming to your shows that are like the people that come to your show in other cities.
Right.
And then you're like, oh, this is a thing. This isn't just like my nerdy friends. It's like, this is happening to people all over the country. And right. I feel like we like accidentally tapped into something with this band, and it's crazy. It's really funny to like go to different places and you meet like the same kinds of people over and over and over again with the same story, same spot in life. Like that's been really crazy. That's been a really interesting thing. I'm really glad we didn't shoot for like the 14-year-old pop punk, you know?
Yeah. No, for sure. I mean, it's definitely a very that audience is very movable, and you could be you could have a rapid ascent followed by a very dramatic crash.
Sure. I mean, we still could now, you know.
It's true.
It's hard to get people with kids to come out and see a show on a Tuesday night, you know. There's all these other problems that start coming up when, you know, these are the people that come to see you, you know.
Yeah, of course. Well, that's because you guys obviously need to offer you know, child services and nurseries at your shows.
We've talked about it.
You're like, all right, what can we do to make this, you know, a little bit easier? Like, do we bring like 6 cribs? Like, how do we do this?
I actually think that dog sitting would probably be our most lucrative sideshow.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I can't, like the dog's going to scratch the door. You're just like, dude,
yeah.
Well, come on down. We've got a dog walker that's ready to hang out. I love that. And so the last thing I want to hit on was like, obviously, because you've led such a, you know, for lack of a better term, like transient lifestyle, has it been difficult to kind of, you know, feel, I mean, like obviously cultivate relationships and feel like you have some semblance of a home life, because obviously you've been, you know, absent by choice. But you know, how has that kind of transpired? I mean, like, are you in a current relationship now?
Yeah. Actually, just got engaged this year. I'm really, really going for it this year.
You,
yeah.
You are. Congratulations. How long have you guys been together?
Almost 7 years, actually. We met at a Paint It Black show.
Oh, perfect. Perfect.
Yeah, right.
Dan Yemen brings people together.
Yeah, pretty much.
So since she's been in your life for a while, obviously I'm sure there were growing pains in regards to that, and her being obviously understanding, because obviously she's still with you, but you know, I'm sure there's a lot of sort of, and I wouldn't even say negotiations, but just kind of like finding, you know, the water finds its own level sort of thing.
Yeah, I think so. And so it's kind of cool. Like we really met like, the very, very end of JB. So like she's been with me through this whole thing with the new band, and it's been really cool to like, it's like I said, it's like with everything else, it's just like really cool watching everything sort of just grow together and like become this big like collective, you know. It's I really felt like, for the long story short with all that, is like I'm really enjoying the consistency. It's like a novelty for me at this point, where like, you know, everything has been relatively the same for me, and I've been able to like work on everything, you know, whether it's my, you know, personal relationships or work or the band or whatever. It's like everything has been one continual thought. Everything works together. It's like I'm surrounded by all these really great, positive, interesting people. Mm-hmm. And like, that's really new to me relatively in the, you know, the whole of my life at this point, where like everything is just kind of in one spot for the first time ever.
Yeah.
So like, it's just fascinating to do. I love it. Like I really, like I've lived in the same house now for 4 years. That's totally new to me. I was moving around every 6 months, you know, before that.
Right.
I don't know what happens next, but I'm in a good spot now.
Yeah. Yeah. And you obviously don't feel that, that sense of, I guess, restlessness that obviously, can sometimes, you know, kind of creep into your head as a trans, as a person who's used to a transient lifestyle. There's none of that, like, oh man, like I feel like, not even so much like the pull of the road, but just like that sort of, you know, day-to-day adventure sort of stuff.
Yeah. But in a way, I'm glad I did everything. Like I have no regrets at this point, because I feel like I've seen the other side of so much of this that like where I'm at now is fucking awesome.
Sure. Sure. That's a very good point. It's like, yeah, if you've been, for lack of a better term, fortunate enough to, you know, play in front of 20 people in Montreal, there's definitely that humbling experience that you go through, where you can kind of come, the finer things in life can taste a little bit better, because you're just like, oh man, I'm not there anymore. I'm not crying in a bathroom.
Because in the snow in Detroit, and yeah, right.
Yeah, everyone has one of those moments.
Totally.
Where it's like, I use Montreal because that was my moment of just like crying in a bathroom, being like, "What the fuck am I doing with my life? Like, yeah. where am I? Where was your moment? Where was your moment of like just you had to get away, you had to cry, you had to call your mom, you had to do that. Where was one of your moments?
I got fired in a rainstorm in Chicago playing to 15 people at a bar that was giving every band member free Long Island iced teas. Okay. That was like the deal. So our tire burst in the rain. We couldn't figure out how to like fix it. Our like tire iron wasn't working. I guess it was like rusted,
okay,
or something to the wheels. So like we're in, like in rain at like 3 a.m, like obliterated, no job, show sucked. Like it was awful, like yeah. Rock bottom. Like that was it. Some part of Chicago I have not been back to since.
Especially because obviously since you weren't sober, but you still had that level of clarity, being like, what am I doing with my life?
Yeah, it's like, here we are. And everybody's like, we're going to go to the dance club. And I was like, I'm going to sit in the van and just kill myself. Like, we're just like,
yeah, I am going to be the most somber person for the next few hours. So please leave me alone.
Yeah, it was awful.
Well,
so thank you, Chicago. The lowest point of my life and the highest point of my life.
That's I'm very glad that you have polarizing experiences in the same city.
Yeah, it's nice.
Well, I really, really appreciate hanging out on the phone with you. This has been fun for me, and obviously like been in the same rooms and have probably like brushed shoulders, but just have never met.
Yeah, man. Yeah, thanks so much. This is really cool.
I always take a really huge breath before doing this outro. I realize that. I just go, like I'm getting ready to yell. Speaking of yelling, I am on stage soon, like very soon, like on January 19th, which is Martin Luther King Day, Monday, January 19th. I feel like an announcer for Sunday, Sunday, Sunday. So anyways, if you're in the Southern California area and would like to see my old band Taken play some melodic hardcore songs for you, I would love to meet you. I would love for you to join the party. We are playing, you know, with a little band called Seosin, you know, with their original vocalist, Anthony Green. No big deal. Anthony's going to be on the show soon. It'll be a while. I want to get him in the right headspace. I think over the phone / Skype interview may be rough, because, you know, he's got kids and there's a bunch of people pulling at him in from so many different directions. Anyways, I digress. Thank you. Wasn't John great? Such a down-to-earth dude. I love people that are so comfortable in the role that their band plays in independent music. They're just like, yeah, we'll tour when it makes sense, and we'll put out music, and we'll just be doing our own thing over here. I love that. And it's exactly what Restorations is. So Tom Richfield, producer, got to give that credit note. Tom, I love you. Just putting it in there. Oh, yes. Hopefully by the next show, I will be alleviated of this horrible plumbing / leak issue, and I'll be in better spirits. Send some positive vibes my direction. And until next week, please be safe, everybody. Amen.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.